Imagine your normal weekend routine. You wake up, you load up your gear, pull up the map on your phone to head out to your favorite local spot.
Right, getting ready to head out.
Yeah, but when you look at the screen, you realize the government has just permanently barricaded like 40% of the roads, trails, and public parks in your county.
Oh, wow, 40%.
40%. And we're not talking about a temporary construction detour. You are locked out for years. You've been exploring these spaces your entire life, and suddenly, overnight, they are just erased from public use.
Just gone.
Right. Your access is gone with the stroke of a pen.
It's a genuinely staggering concept to wrap your head around, honestly. I mean, we operate with this underlying assumption that public space is permanent.
For sure.
We assume that if a mountain or a desert is designated as public land, it's always going to be there waiting for us, as long as we follow the rules, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
So when that permanence is shattered abruptly and on a massive scale, it forces this huge psychological reckoning for the people who rely on those spaces, whether it's for their livelihood, recreation, or just mental health.
Well, that infrastructure shock is not a hypothetical scenario for the people who spend their time out in the Western Mojave Desert because, literally overnight, a federal court order wiped out 2,200 miles of public off-highway vehicle routes.
Yes.
Gone. Barricaded. Legally off-limits. So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking an event that sent absolute shockwaves through the outdoor community.
And we really have a highly provocative lens to view this through today.
We do. Our roadmap today is this fascinating internal memo. It's dated April 16th, 2026, and it's titled, They Closed 2,200 Miles.
Very straight to the point.
Yeah, no ambiguity there. The author is Mike Isaacs. He's the founder of a startup called Timber Outdoor, and he distributed this memo exclusively to their Sovereign Circle members.
Right, and it provides this incredibly raw, unfiltered look at the fallout of this whole judicial decision.
So today, we're going to look at the staggering scale of this land closure in the Western Mojave, which is often referred to as the WEMO Desert. We'll analyze the grueling 20-year legal battle that quietly churned in the background before dropping this hammer.
Yeah, the timeline is wild.
It really is. And perhaps most interestingly, we're going to explore the collision of reactions. On one side, you have grassroots advocates fighting this desperate legal war. And on the other, just absolute pin drop silence from the $1.3 trillion mainstream outdoor industry.
But, before we really get into the mechanics of how this happened, we probably need to acknowledge the environment we're stepping into here.
Oh, absolutely.
We are walking into an active minefield today. I mean, this is the ultimate high-stakes friction point between environmental conservation and public land access. People literally dedicate their entire lives to both sides of this argument.
Yeah, so let's be crystal clear right up front. We are not here to play referee. We're not picking a winner between the environmentalists and the off-roaders.
Right.
And we are definitely not here to blindly endorse the specific viewpoints of Mike Isaacs or his startup. Our mission is just to look at the raw mechanics laid out in this memo, tear them apart, and understand the deep underlying why behind this collision.
Exactly. We want to figure out how the system works, or I guess in some views, how it's fundamentally broken.
Right. So let's start with the sheer physical scale of this judicial action, because the numbers here are what make this so unprecedented.
Yeah, so on January 23, 2026, U.S. District Judge Susan Ilston signed an order officially closing 2,200 miles of designated OHV routes in the WIMO.
2,200 miles.
Right. And the closure then officially went into effect just a few weeks later, on March 24, 2026.
I mean, just to put that in perspective, that is roughly the driving distance from Los Angeles to Chicago.
Wow.
Just imagine a single dirt trail stretching across the entire country, and then someone locking a gate at the entrance and saying, "Nope, no one is allowed to use it."
It fundamentally alters the map of California. That single court order represents 37% of the entire WEMO route network.
37%.
37%. And, this isn't a scenario where the Bureau of Land Management can just quickly patch up a few environmental reports and reopen the gates next month.
Right, it's not a quick fix.
Not at all. The memo points out that the earliest a revised BLM analysis could even potentially lead to reopening these routes is 2029.
2029. So the public is locked out for 3 years at an absolute minimum, and that's assuming the government bureaucracy moves at top speed.
Which, let's be honest, is basically never the case.
Right, never. But I want to dig into the timeline here, because this massive closure didn't just fall out of a clear blue sky. A judge didn't just wake up in 2026 and decide to erase a third of the desert map.
No, not at all. This closure is basically the violent conclusion of a lawsuit that was initiated 2 decades ago.
2 decades.
Yeah, back in 2006. The original legal action was brought forward by the Center for Biological Diversity. They filed this suit on behalf of specific, highly vulnerable local flora and fauna out there in the Mojave.
Okay, so what specifically were they trying to protect?
Mainly the desert tortoise and a rare plant known as the Lane Mountain milk vetch.
Okay, I really struggle to comprehend the timeline here. A 20-year legal battle resulting in a sudden overnight closure for the public. Think about a city's infrastructure.
Right, give me an analogy.
Imagine if the city barricaded 40% of your local subway lines to protect, like, a historic foundation. You've been riding that train for 20 years, maybe your whole adult life, and suddenly on a random Tuesday, there's a padlock on the station gate.
Yeah.
How does a lawsuit simmer for 2 decades and then suddenly manifest as this abrupt, massive loss of access for the everyday person? Like, what does that say about the mechanics of how our land is managed?
Well, I think it exposes a massive inherent flaw in how legal time and human time operate. Because they run on completely different clocks.
What do you mean by that?
So environmental law, especially litigation driven by a group like the Center for Biological Diversity, it's designed to move at a glacial pace. A lawsuit filed in 2006 triggers years of biological surveys. Then you have the drafting of environmental impact statements, which take years.
Right. Lots of paperwork.
Endless paperwork.
Mm.
Then public comment periods. Then the agency issues a revised plan and the environmental group sues again, claiming the revision is insufficient.
So it's just this constant loop.
Exactly. It's an endless loop of bureaucratic ping pong happening in federal courtrooms and agency cubicles. It's a slow, methodical machine designed to ensure a species doesn't blink out of existence.
But the person out riding their dirt bike on a Saturday has absolutely no visibility into that courtroom ping pong.
Precisely the issue. For the modern public land user like, the family loading up their camper on a Friday afternoon in March 2026, there is no 20-year transition period. They aren't reading court dockets online.
Right, they're just checking the weather.
Exactly. So one weekend, the route they've driven since they were teenagers is open. The next weekend, by judicial decree, driving that exact same dirt path is suddenly a federal offense.
Wow.
The collision here tells us that the reality of land management is no longer contested out on the dirt. It's fought in a courtroom, where the slow preservation of nature abruptly crashes into the daily lives of the public.
But when that crash happened, the public didn't just sit quietly.
No, they definitely did not.
The memo details this immediate, visceral response from the motorized recreation community. When the gavel came down, grassroots groups like the Blue Ribbon Coalition, Cal Four Wheel, and the American Sand Association, they went straight to war.
Right, they were organized.
Highly organized. They didn't just tweet about it. They issued formal statements, filed extensive administrative comments, and actively coordinated heavy legal action.
And the depth of that grassroots legal infrastructure is incredibly sophisticated. I mean, Isaacs notes that the Blue Ribbon Coalition, for instance, has been fighting these specific types of public land access battles for nearly 40 years.
40 years of this?
Yeah. They are deeply entrenched in the mechanics of environmental litigation. In response to this specific WEMO closure, the memo points out that the BRC filed what's called a motion to intervene in federal court.
Okay, so for those of us who don't spend our free time reading legal statutes, what does a motion to intervene actually look like on the ground? Why is that such a big deal?
It's a really critical, aggressive legal maneuver. Because in a standard environmental lawsuit of this type, you usually have two main players in the room. You have the environmental group suing, and the government agency, in this case, the BLM, defending itself.
Right.
But the government's lawyers are primarily defending the agency's bureaucratic process. They are not necessarily in that courtroom to fiercely defend the dirt biker's right to ride.
That makes sense. They're defending the paperwork.
Exactly. So a motion to intervene is essentially a third party, the motorized advocacy groups, forcing your way into the lawsuit. They're basically telling the judge, the government does not represent our specific interests, and we demand a seat at the table because this ruling directly impacts our lives.
I imagine that's not cheap.
No, it takes massive funding and heavy legal expertise to pull off.
So you have these scrappy, donor-funded grassroots organizations throwing themselves into the legal crossfire to keep the public land open.
Right.
But here is the massive contrast that Isaac zeroes in on in the Timber Memo. While the OHB community is fighting tooth and nail in federal court, You look over at the broader outdoor industry.
And it's just silence.
Absolute silence.
Crickets.
Yeah, the starkness of that silence is really what makes this memo so compelling.
I find this dynamic mind-boggling because Isaacs describes the broader outdoor industry as a $1.3 trillion machine.
Trillion with a T.
Right. We're talking about massive corporate brands that sell you the moisture wicking fleeces, the $400 high-tech tents, the ultralight trail shoes. Their entire marketing universe revolves around telling you to get outside and explore the wild.
Definitely.
But when a judge physically erases 2,200 miles of the actual outside, these trillion-dollar brands are absolutely nowhere to be found. They don't issue statements, they don't file motions, they just keep selling jackets.
It is a glaring contradiction, and Isaacs offers a highly analytical theory to explain it. He calls it complicated math.
Complicated math. Okay, break that down for me.
So when you look at the massive trade associations that lobby for the outdoor industry, they are fundamentally built as big tents.
Right.
Their membership is vast. You've got everything from ski resorts to kayak manufacturers.
Right.
But the true limiting factor, the real math, lies in their dependency on the federal government.
Let me stop you there. Explain that dependency. How does selling a kayak make you dependent on the BLM?
Well, think about what a massive outdoor brand actually requires to operate at scale. They aren't just manufacturing gear in a vacuum.
Okay.
They sponsor massive, heavily populated trail running events. They shoot multi-million dollar commercial campaigns in iconic desert landscapes. They operate guided expedition concessions.
Ah, I see.
And every single one of those lucrative activities requires a special recreation permit issued by agencies like the BLM or the Forest Service.
Got it.
So they depend entirely on maintaining smooth, non-antagonistic institutional relationships with the very government agencies that manage the land.
Let me push back on this, though, because it sounds incredibly cynical.
Oh, it is.
If an industry generates over $1 trillion by profiting off the concept of public land, but they stay totally silent when the public is locked out because they're terrified of losing their commercial photo shoot permits, aren't they just prioritizing their corporate business model over the public's actual right to access the land?
Yes. It is a deeply cynical reality, but it's the classic dilemma of institutional survival. Large institutions, by their very nature, eventually become inherently risk-averse.
Right. Protect the bottom line.
Exactly. They have massive payrolls to meet, shareholders to satisfy, and incredibly complex political waters to navigate.
Oh.
Furthermore, their customer base is politically diverse.
That's true.
If a major hiking boot brand takes a militant, highly public stand defending motorized dirt bikes against environmental conservation groups protecting a tortoise, they risk a massive boycott.
Oh, from a huge portion of their own customers who might prioritize the tortoise over the dirt bike.
Precisely. The complicated math dictates that the financial risk of speaking up far outweighs the benefit. Their primary objective shifts from pure wilderness advocacy to just maintaining the bureaucratic status quo that allows their revenue streams to function.
No, they are completely paralyzed by their own size and their own business model.
Yeah, they're stuck.
Which creates a massive vacuum in leadership. And really, that brings us to why Mike Isaacs wrote this memo in the first place. He makes a point to state that his startup, Timber Outdoor, does not share that constraint.
Right. They are outside that specific ecosystem.
They don't rely on that legacy web of federal permits and political appeasement, which gives them the freedom to look at this closure and just call it what it is.
And what makes his perspective so unique here is that Timber Outdoor isn't even an OHV company. They do not manufacture dirt bikes or ATVs. They are an outdoor startup with a much broader, almost sociological mission.
Isaacs writes that his mission is to open up outdoor life for the 268 million Americans who have, quote, never been invited to participate.
It's a huge number.
It is. He looks at the WeMo closure not just as a loss of dirt paths, but as a philosophical barrier. He summarizes his entire stance in one incredibly powerful absolute statement. He says, every closure is a wall.
Every closure is a wall. It's a very potent metaphor because it fundamentally shifts the conversation. While it takes a highly technical legal dispute about biological surveys and route designations, and it transforms it into this profound debate about human boundaries, sovereignty, and exclusion.
And he's very clear about exactly who is standing on the wrong side of that wall when it gets built. When a judge erases 2,200 miles of access, the loser is not just the stereotypical off-roader covered in dust and energy drink logo.
That's right. That's the stereotype, but it's not the whole reality.
He outlines a deeply human demographic argument here.
Yeah. He argues that the true casualty of these closures is the everyday citizen who relies on mechanized access. It's the working-class family that drove 4 hours from a crowded city just to camp in that specific patch of desert terrain because, well, it was the only affordable vacation they could take.
Right. And it's the veteran who relies on a four-wheel drive vehicle to reach the remote, quiet landscapes that help them heal from trauma they sustained serving the country.
Exactly. It's the retiree who has worked their entire life paying taxes into the system that manages this land, and who has, as Isaacs puts it, earned every acre of that horizon, but whose knees can no longer support a 10-mile hike.
And it's the kid growing up surrounded by concrete who might literally never get another chance to see that kind of raw open space if the roads leading into it are just barricaded.
Yeah.
Which brings us to what I think is the most provocative, really uncomfortable point in the entire memo, this concept of the athletically elite.
Ah, yes. This is a crucial philosophical concept to unpack. Isaacs is challenging the dominant narrative of modern outdoor recreation here.
Right.
He argues that access to the outdoors is not, and should never be, a privilege reserved strictly for the athletically elite. It sure that'd be a reward for having the disposable income to purchase a $500 ultralight tent.
Or for possessing the perfect biomechanics required to hike 20 miles into the deep backcountry with a heavy pack. It feels like Isaacs is arguing that the modern outdoor industry has secretly turned public land into an exclusive VIP club.
That's a great way to put it.
If you look the part, if you have the expensive gear, and if your body can handle the extreme physical toll of deep wilderness hiking, the velvet rope opens for now. You get to enjoy the majesty of the land.
But if you don't.
Right. But if you're that disabled veteran in a Jeep or that family in a minivan, the bouncer basically turns you away at the gate. Yeah. Isaacs is saying flat out, access is a fundamental right.
Yes.
Public land belongs to every single American. It does not belong to the federal courts and does not belong to the managing agencies. It is public.
It's a very radical assertion of public land sovereignty. Mm. He really believes that access is a right that must be actively, aggressively defended precisely because our legal institutions are not designed to protect human access.
They're designed for the tortoise.
Right. Bureaucracies are designed to mitigate risk, avoid litigation, and enforce environmental statutes. If we accept the premise that public land truly belongs to everyone, then locking out the veteran who requires a vehicle or the family that cannot physically hike in, well, it fundamentally alters the very definition of the word public. It becomes conditional.
I want to challenge that absolute sovereignty argument, though, because if we swing the pendulum entirely in the other direction, we run into a biological wall. How do we reconcile the fundamental right of the veteran to drive a vehicle on that land with the fundamental right of the public to have the desert tortoise actually exist for future generations?
It's the ultimate question.
Extinction is forever, you know?
Yeah.
If those 2,200 miles stay open and the tortoise is wiped off the face of the earth because of human impact, haven't we also robbed the public of something completely irreplaceable?
Yeah, that is the ultimate crucible of public land management. You've just articulated the defining environmental challenge of our time.
It seems impossible to solve.
On one side of the ledger, you have the fragile reality of biodiversity. The courts and the agencies are utilizing the only blunt instruments they have, like massive physical closures, to prevent permanent, irreversible ecological loss.
Right. They're trying to stop a species from vanishing forever.
But on the other side of the ledger, you have the human element. Absolute biological preservation often requires total human exclusion. But true public sovereignty demands inclusive, mechanized access for all demographics.
Finding the balance between those two absolutes feels nearly impossible. And currently, that balance is just being fought over with lawsuits and padlocks.
It's a monumental challenge.
Yeah.
And it really forces you to step back and examine your own baseline assumptions about what it means to share a country.
So true. Well, let's bring this deep dive full circle and synthesize exactly what we've explored today.
Sure. So we started by examining the sheer, staggering scope of the Western Mojave closure. We're looking at a federal court order that erased 2,200 miles of designated OHV routes.
Yeah, an overnight closure of 37% of the entire WEMO network, with the public locked out until at least 2029.
Then we dug into the glacial bureaucratic roots of that closure, that 20-year legal war initiated by the Center for Biological Diversity back in 2006 to protect the desert tortoise and the Lane Mountain milkfetch.
Which highlighted the massive disconnect between how slowly the courts operate and how abruptly the public feels the consequences.
Right. We then analyzed the intense contrast in the public's reaction. we unpack the complex mechanics of how grassroots motorized groups like the Blue Ribbon Coalition force their way into the legal fight through motions to intervene.
And we juxtapose their aggressive advocacy against the deafening silence of the $1.3 trillion outdoor industry. That calculated silence driven by the complicated math of federal permitting, risk aversion, and institutional self-preservation.
And finally, we explored the passionate philosophical argument from Mike Isaacs in Timber Outdoor, his assertion that every closure is a wall.
It challenges us to look at the demographics of who actually loses when public land is locked away. It's this urgent plea that public land access must remain a fundamental right for all Americans, the veteran, the retiree, the city kid, and not just a VIP privilege reserved for the able-bodied, athletically elite.
It's an incredibly complex web where legal precedent, corporate self-interest, biological survival, and grassroots philosophy all violently intersect on a dirt road out in the Mojave Desert.
It truly is. So as we wrap up this deep dive, we want you to reflect on your own relationship with the spaces you explore.
Right.
Whether you are someone who hikes deep into the backcountry with a backpack, someone who drives rugged trails in a 4x4 on the weekends, or someone who lives in the heart of a concrete city and just dreams of one day seeing that wide open desert space. How do you define what makes land truly public?
Does it mean it's preserved perfectly, or does it mean you can actually touch it?
Exactly. It requires us to look beyond our own preferred methods of recreation and seriously consider the broader, long-term implications of how we balance sovereignty with stewardship.
It really does.
And it leaves us with one final lingering thought to mull over, building on the tension we've explored today. Think back to that opening image of your local parks vanishing overnight. If the legal institutions designed to protect our public lands increasingly decide that the absolute only way to save an ecosystem is to physically lock the everyday public out of it, at what point does public land stop being a place you can experience and start becoming a museum you are only allowed to look at from the outside?